This is Fresh Air. I'm Frank Browning. Yesterday, Israel's Army Chief of Staff, Dan Shamron, unleashed a furor in the country when he said that Israel could safely give up land in the occupied territories in exchange for a peace agreement with its Arab neighbors. Immediately, some members of the Israeli cabinet called for his resignation, and others reaffirmed the government's absolute intransigence on any land for peace plan. The conflict between Arabs and Israelis is the longest, most visible conflict in this century, a seemingly unending battle to which American governments and news media continuously return. Today, we want to step back a little, talk about who the players are, where they came from, and why this crisis seems almost incapable of resolution. Charles Smith is a Middle East historian at San Diego State University. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Charles Smith, is it fair to say that what we're looking at is two people who have valid deeds to the same piece of real estate?
I think we have to say that. We have to say that from their own perspectives, they assume that they have an absolute right to the land. But the claims go back, from the Zionist point of view, to the mid and late 19th century, whereas the Palestinian Arabs simply assumed because they were living in the land of Palestine had a right to be there. So they did not really formulate rights per se until Zionism, as a threat to them, claiming the right to take over the land they lived on, challenged their assumptions that they could live there.
What is Zionism? What is this notion of an Israeli state? Where does the idea that Jews in that part of the world needed a nation, where does that come from?
Well, Zionism, as the word Zion, harks back to the ancient kingdoms of Israel. But Zionism, in its modern context, is a secular, modern nationalist movement seeking to establish a state in Palestine in the lands that were the former kingdom of Israel or the different kingdoms of Israel in the pre-Christian era. And this was formed in Eastern Europe, most particularly in Russia, from the 1870s on by secular Jews who had left the religious habitat that dominated Jewish culture in Eastern Europe but could not be assimilated into Russian culture at the time because of anti-Semitism. Consequently, they began to think that they should look elsewhere, and where better to look than where Jews had lived 2,000 years before. So this is really the first formulation of what we might call Zionism.
Well, isn't it related to the whole invention of the idea of a nation? I mean, the nations are a relatively new invention in the world, aren't they?
Exactly. Nationalism itself can really be traced to the French Revolution and then developments with this idea throughout the 19th century. So the Jews were adopting an idea for themselves that they should have a nation as Jews. Now, this idea, of course, was totally foreign to any non-Western culture of the time, because they were living in what we would call traditional societies, which were quite viable, with high levels of culture at times, but in which identity was on the basis of kinship or religion, but in which nations in the modern nation-state sense had never existed, and there was no reason for them to exist.
There were no Arab nations as such?
Not as such, no. There were people who thought of themselves as Arabs and identified as Arabs or as Muslims or as Christians or whatever. But a nation per se, as opposed to dynasties, great dynasties, had never existed, simply because this was not part of the cultural landscape.
Well, and isn't it also important to remember that not all Jews were sold on the idea of nationhood?
Well, this is very important. Zionism really got a tremendous push in the 1890s because of the Dreyfus case in France, anti-Semitic utterances, and Theodor Herzl writing his book, Der Judenstaat, which then led to the formation of the World Zionist Organization in 1897. But even from that point onwards, Zionism was essentially limited to small groups of people, even in Eastern Europe. And in the Western world, Western Europe and America, Zionism really had very little support, even down until after World War I and into the 1920s and 1930s. It was only with the knowledge of Hitlerian Germany in the 1930s and the Holocaust that you begin to get massive mobilization and massive support for the Zionist movement in the Western world, particularly in the United States.
So if we're taking this model of two people, each of whom hold valid deeds to the same piece of territory, how do we get the boundaries of what is today Israel?
Well, I would question whether we can assume that everyone has valid deeds to the same territory. If we did that, then Arab Muslims would have a valid deed to Spain, since they control the area and lived there for over 700 years. The valid deeds is a Western legal concept, and I think we assume that both sides have valid legal deeds today simply because the situation is intractable. The Jewish claim, the Zionist claim, was based on residence 2,000 years before. The Palestinian Arab claim was based on the fact that they were living there. And the origins of the real conflict come once you have major Zionist immigration in the first decade of the century and open propaganda and claims that a Jewish state would be created. And at that time, you begin to get very open Palestinian-Arab resistance. But the true issue, as defined in Western terms, in terms of dividing up the land, really comes in World War I, with great power division of the Middle East and imperial spoils, and Zionism's alignment with Great Britain in as a hope of gaining Palestine. And they were successful in doing this through the Balfour Declaration of November 1917.
Well, what we saw was the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, which had pretty much ruled that entire part of the world, right?
Right.
And so enter onto the scene, Britain and France.
Enter Britain and France. Both had ambitions in the remaining lands of the Arab Middle East that had not been taken over by them in the period before World War I. Palestine, Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, etc. A religious official in the Hejaz in Western Arabia, the Sharif Hussein of Mecca, had already been in contact with the British in Cairo, seeking total independence from Ottoman control. Now, out of this, there developed a correspondence with the British representative in Cairo, it was called the Hussein McMahon correspondence, in which the Sharif Hussein claimed Arab independence after the war for all the lands of what we would call the Arab Middle East today, including Palestine. And he had every right to assume that Palestine would be included by the British because they had been dropping propaganda leaflets since late 1914 promising Arab independence, and they had specifically mentioned Palestine in these leaflets.
Now let's be clear, because most people don't know these details here.
Right.
The leaflets were being dropped
by plane and ship and distributed, right?
By the Western powers.
By Great Britain, out of Cairo. They were dropping these leaflets in Arabia, they were dropping them in Palestine and in Syria.
And there was an assumption that the Zionist purpose would be realized with some sort of state created, and that there would be some kind of state which would be home to the residents, to the Palestinians.
No, not at all. We have to correct this. The Zionist issue does not come up until 1917. This is earlier in the war in 1915, 1916. And at this time, you have this correspondence where the British exclude some territory from potential Arab independence after the war, but never mentioned Palestine. It is later claimed that they meant to do this. Perhaps they did, but they did not. And the Sharif Hussein assumed that Palestine was still included in the lands to be promised him. At the end of the war, the British intelligence analysts preparing summaries for the people going to the peace conference stated quite clearly that while the British did later in 1917 promise Palestine to the Zionist movement, they had also, if only implicitly, promised Palestine to the Arabs. And there were two conflicting promises that existed, and the question was, how are they going to resolve it?
And indeed, it was the strength of the Zionist movement that invented Israel in 1948, certainly not out of the benevolence of Britain.
Oh, not at all. You had a very strong military movement, a very able one, organized by the Zionists in Palestine. It was strong politically as well as militarily, whereas the Palestinian movement in Palestine was politically bereft of leadership and politically fragmented and had no military force to speak of whatsoever. You also had great motivation on the part of the Jews because of the knowledge of the Holocaust, in the sense that recent developments after World War I proved the claim that the Jews needed a state. The Palestinians actually seem to have assumed simply that because they were still in 1948 on the eve of the birth of Israel, double the size of the Jewish population and owned twice the land, that they had a right still to the whole area, and they refused to compromise. So when a partition plan was proposed in 1947, the Zionist movement accepted this because they would get at least part of Palestine as a state of Israel, and the Palestinian Arabs rejected it because it again was an outside force seeking to determine their fate.
My guest is Charles Smith. He is a Middle East historian at San Diego State University. We'll be right back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Historian Charles Smith is my guest. We're talking about the roots of the Arab-Israeli conflict. Israel was formed in 1948. The crisis didn't go away. And nobody really seemed fully secure in their control of the deed, as if we see this as a question of who has the deed to the territory. What are the seeds of the ongoing conflict that continued to be planted and harvested even up into the current Gulf War? How do we see how that construction of Israel affected the possibility of any resolution?
Well, I think we have to divide this period down to the Gulf War into two separate periods. One would be down to the 1967 war, and then the post-67 war period when Israel controls, at that time, the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, and all of the Sinai Peninsula. In the period before that, from 1948 to 1967, you have essentially an Arab state conflict and hostility with Israel, in which Arab states are, at least verbally, and sometimes through sanctions or blockades, in other ways, aggressive towards Israel.
Well, they're the declared enemies of Israel, right?
They stated that Israel had no right to exist, and they refused to recognize them. And you had a continuing state of war through the fact that you had armistices. You never had settlements, even after 1948, because the agreements that were made were armistices or suspensions of hostility. Now, you also had Israeli efforts at times through preemptive strikes to take out people they deemed to be hostile to them and who might be potential threats. And so you had, for example, the 1956 Suez Crisis, in which Britain, France, and Israel attacked Egypt in the hope of overthrowing Gamal Abdel Nasser. Now, in the 1960s, Israel became the particular focus of what we might call intra-Arab hostility. Radical Arab nationalism, particularly fostered by Syria, challenging Nasser for leadership of the Arab world, with Israel being the whipping boy in between. Syria, in this process, began to encourage a radical Palestinian group called Al-Fatah, led by Yasser Arafat, to attack into Israel from Jordan. And this destabilization was aimed not only at Israel, but at Jordan, because King Hussein of Jordan was considered, in the language of the time, a feudal monarch who had to be overthrown. Now, this crisis, with the aid of Arafat and Al-Fatah, ultimately led to the outbreak of the 1967 war. Because Nasser, responding to Arab criticism and insults that he was soft on Israel, you had a United Nations peacekeeping force in the Sinai as a buffer between him and Israel following the Suez Crisis of 1956, ousted the UN force and took over areas that had been used to blockade Israeli shipping in 1956. But this did not actually lead Israel to attack Egypt. Israel decided to attack Egypt once they knew that Nasser was seeking a peaceful way out. And Israeli politicians and military leaders in 1967 decided that Nasser should not be able to get away with the crisis that had ensued, and it would be a way also of destroying the military arsenal Soviet supplied that Nasser had built up in the Sinai. This was a brilliant success, and when Jordan came in, Israel responded, took over East Jerusalem, the West Bank, etc., and the Golan Heights, along with the Sinai Peninsula. And that established a new situation that, in many ways, has lasted to the present day, although, as you know, the Sinai Peninsula was returned to Egypt following the Camp David Accords and the Egyptian-Israeli Peace Agreement in 1978-1979. But a whole new period came in then, with new attempts to define what might be the peace efforts and resolution that might ensue at some future date. And Security Council Resolution 242, passed in November of 1967, was to be the basis of that. And this has been interpreted in various ways by various parties ever since, because it denounces and renounces the idea that land should be controlled through force and calls for secure boundaries. At the same time, it states that Israel should return territories taken in the recent conflict, with the word "the" deliberately left out, so it would not have the idea that all the territories should be returned, particularly meaning, in this case, I think, the West Bank.
Well, now, and this is of course, where we are today.
And this is where we are, with Israel claiming that those territories might be substantial, and the Arabs always claiming, with, by the way, the United States' assent in terms of their interpretation, that in general they expected Israel to give up most of the territories. Now, in terms of your opening remarks, you have also had a debate that has become increasingly intense in Israel in recent years over whether the territories, and particularly the West Bank, are absolutely crucial to the security of Israel. And military leaders, such as Shomron, have argued that they are not, that in terms of long-term security interests, peace might be more valuable to Israel than holding on to territory. The claims to hold on, particularly to the West Bank, are much more political and religious and supported by right-wing politicians who see these areas as Judea and Samaria, which is really where the original Jews came in the 13th and 12th centuries of the pre-Christian era.
So here we are. The Gulf War has happened. The Palestinians verbally chose to side themselves with Saddam Hussein, and in some sense of public relations, at least, seem to have their stock has declined, and the sympathy for them to some degree has been weathered on has been diminished. But on the other hand, we now see the U.S. in a position to push the Arab countries, particularly Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, conceivably Syria, into a different sort of relationship with Israel. And it's to what extent? How do you see the situation changed relative to finding some resolution, and how the alliances are going to form?
Well, this is a very difficult question, and I'm not sure that it's capable of resolution. You've suggested that the United States should push its Arab allies, and I think they will try to push them. But there's another side to this. They will have to push Israel as well. The basic question may be, will the United States be willing to push Israel with the same force or powers of suggestion that it will use on its Arab allies to seek to make compromises to resolve this issue? Now, in resolving this, they will have to deal with the Palestinian question. And from the Arab side, from the side of our Arab allies, whoever they are, there must be some sort of independent Palestinian entity on the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip. Now, it may be connected to Jordan. It may even exclude the PLO. We don't know about that. It's rather interesting how the PLO can survive at times. There is certainly no great eagerness on the part of many of our allies, including Egypt and Saudi Arabia and Kuwait at this moment, to allow the PLO to have any role at all. And Israel has been absolutely adamant about this. But that does not exclude the Palestinians in the territories from having a voice. And many of them, whether they will say it or not openly or will be recognized by others, are aligned with the PLO. I think we have to look here at something the United States may be falling into a trap. In the spring of 1990, when there was increasing violence in the West Bank, and after an Israeli had killed four Palestinians in May, Arafat asked for a UN Security Council investigating team to go in to monitor the situation. 14 out of 15 members of the Security Council approved of that suggestion. The United States vetoed it. Then you had the crisis over the terrorist attack by Abu Abbas coming out of Baghdad, and later on the suspension of the dialogue with the PLO by President Bush on June 20th. In that speech, President Bush said something very interesting. He said he realized that his Arab allies, the most moderate Arab states, and his European allies disagreed with what he was doing. They disagreed with that judgment. They disagreed with the policy of the United States towards attempts to resolve the outstanding question of the Palestinians. And this is where I see, down the road, the possibility of the United States becoming isolated with Israel against its former allies in this Gulf crisis, precisely because we may try to control it unilaterally and be unwilling to respond to what I see as the real needs of the Palestinians in the territories, irrespective of the question of whether the PLO is leading them or not.
Well, let's look at what possible influence the U.S. might have toward Israel. I mean, what cards does the United States have? In fact, could Israel exist without U.S. money?
Absolutely not. $3 billion a year and now more. And as a matter of fact, we have just awarded them $650 million in war damages. And AIPAC, the American-Israel Political Action Committee, came out and said that if sufficient money was not awarded, they would threatened to campaign against Republican candidates in the elections in 1992. So this is already a major lobbying issue from the point of view of Israel supporters in the United States. The only real impact the United States could ever have, and that is very doubtful in political terms, would be to reduce aid to Israel. And I frankly don't see that happening.
Well, what's in it for U.S. interests to maintain unflagging support of the Israeli position? After all, I mean, Israel for a very long time has argued that it is the United States' most reliable ally, both politically and militarily in the Middle East. But here we have the first real military showdown in the Middle East with Iraq, and Israel played not only no military role at all in support of the U.S., we put Israel to the side and made our arrangements with the Arab countries. I mean, isn't the claim that Israel is the only reliable ally a little bit diminished now? So why should the Bush administration, why should one suppose the Bush administration is going to remain that deeply wed to Israel?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you've raised a very good point, because the argument that Israel was our most reliable ally had nothing to do with the region per se. It was what we call a globalist interpretation, in which Israel was an ally of the United States against Arab states supported by the Soviet Union. In other words, the importance of Israel as an ally to the United States was within a Cold War context. Now, the Gulf crisis has shown the more crucial aspects of regional issues, particularly with respect to the Gulf, the Persian Gulf, and the way that we have relied on Arab allies in order to resolve that. Now, obviously, this is a post-Cold War crisis, which presumably one would hope regional issues would become more important. In this context, Arab allies would appear to be much more important to the security and long-term interests of the United States than would Israel, in purely military terms. We should be committed, it seems to me, to the existence of Israel, but we should also be committed to peace in the region. And in that sense, Israeli policies as they stand at the moment seem rather inimical to the hope of peace in the region, because they no longer serve the military purposes that they did before, and I would question how important those military purposes were at various times.
My guest has been Middle East historian Charles Smith. He is on the faculty at San Diego State University, and he's also the author of Palestine and the Arab-Israeli Conflict. This is Fresh Air.